It's great to have Fiona. She, because I know she'll get in her digs, but she was wise enough to marry a Yorkshireman. And we're going to find out a little bit about him and about her. Just one last thing. I don't know if you heard on the radio a few weeks ago, they interviewed a guy from Yorkshire, and he'd lived in one house, and they went and interviewed this 84-year-old man, and they said, "We understand you've lived in the same house all your life." And he said, "Not yet." Great answer. Fiona, let's give her a very warm welcome, shall we?
Fiona, it is good to have you.
It is true, isn't it, that Roy came from Yorkshire. Whereabouts?
He came from Uddersfield, which is near Halifax and Elland. And Elland hasn't got an H because he never bothered to put an H on it because it made no difference.
Right. But you were very discerning, weren't you, to marry. Especially as you came from the wrong side of the Pennines.
I came from the wrong side of the Pennines because I came from Liverpool. I came from the Wirral. And the Wars of the Roses existed right the way through our marriage.
Quite right, too. Right. But it's interesting, historically, the War of the Roses was triggered by the Lancastrians, wasn't it? So anyway, we'll leave that.
I don't know anything about history.
All right. Fiona, it's good to have you. Whereabouts do you live now?
I live in a place called Gerrard's Cross. Does anybody know Gerrard's Cross? My husband used to say, "I live in Gerrard's Cross. It's a very small place. One lives there." But I'm glad to know that people who live in Maidenhead know it, because otherwise it is a very small place.
It's not that far away, is it?
No, it's very close. It's lovely for me. I only had to drive a few miles.
Great. Well, it's really good to have you. Thanks for stepping in. I'm sorry you're a poor substitute for Emma, but nevertheless...
I'm used to being an understudy, so don't worry.
We've advertised you as an entertainer. Were in the entertainment world, weren't you?
I was never an entertainer.
Well,
I mean,
come on.
I can't stand up and do any... you know, one-liners or anything like that, like you.
You did these long-legged gaiety girl acts.
Oh,
didn't
that's
you?
Different, you know, kick him out.
And you did do that.
Oh yes.
Did you? And somebody told me that you can still do the splits. Is that true?
You don't want me to do them.
No, we don't. No.
Well, I think so. Yes.
That's amazing. All right, let's go back to your upbringing. So you grew up on the Wirral. That's the they call it the Insular Peninsula near to Liverpool.
Very much so. Yes.
And your
place called West Kirby. Does anybody know West Kirby?
Well, West Kirby is quite a nice place, isn't it?
Yes, it's beautiful. Really it lovely.
Got some beach
overlooking
there.
The River Dee and Wales.
And your father was...
He was a GP in the area, yes.
And this was in the days when GPs, you know, worked from their home and everybody came, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. We had the surgeries downstairs and we lived upstairs.
So could you always smell anaesthetics coming up and this sort of thing?
I don't think I ever thought about that, actually.
All right.
Possibly.
And you told me once about the sort of... injured soldiers who used to come back and were accommodated in your home.
Yes, it was amazing because I was born at the beginning of the war. The Second World War.
Yes.
And because my father was a GP, and in those days there was no National Health Service, and he was a doctor 24 hours a day, you know, it didn't make any difference what time of day or night it was. And he was aware that there were soldiers from the Commonwealth, or the colonies as they called them, who were coming out of hospital having been injured during the war, and they had no place to go to convalesce. So my mother turned our sitting room into a convalescent home. We had mattresses all around the floor, and she fed and clothed and watered them and looked after them. On rations, and they didn't even have their own ration books. Right. So it was like feeding the 5,000. I don't know how she did it.
Amazing.
We used to have it was a herbaceous border, but she turned it into a hen run, so we had our own eggs and then our own chickens eventually. Mm. And grew our own vegetables, so she did really well.
And as a little girl, were you always into dancing?
Oh yes, I loved it. I didn't realise how important it would become to me, but I have a sister who's 10 years older than I am, so I was a painful little sister to her. And she said I was so annoying because I never walked anywhere with her. I always danced and really was embarrassing to her.
And eventually you went to dance school, didn't you?
I did. When I was 5 years old, I went to an ordinary little local school. And in those days, we had one dancing class a week that was part of the curriculum. And the dancing teacher was lovely. And after a while, she started to talk to my mother and told her that I showed promise. That's an old-fashioned statement, isn't it?
It is.
Showed promise. So my mother got all excited about it because she, in her younger day, was a ballroom dancing teacher.
All right.
And so she started to ask my dancing teacher what she could do about it. They had lots of conversations, and the upshot was at the age of 9, I was sent to a boarding school 200 miles away in Camberley in Surrey to train in dance and theatre arts.
That's a tough call for a 9-year-old girl. Did you find it hard?
Well, I suppose I never thought about it being hard. I felt so privileged. I was so excited to do something that was so adventurous at that time. You know, looking back, I realised my parents sacrificed a lot in order to be able to send me there. So I was very, very privileged.
Right, and let me just ask about your home. You know, that sort of period in history, I think many people, probably most people, went to church. Did your family go to church?
Yes.
Were you taught to pray?
We all believed in God. I don't think there was any alternative in those days. You know, we went to church. I think during the war, anyway, there was a huge sort of feeling of the need to pray. And we were in a sort of always being bombed over Liverpool. You know, we were in a dangerous area anyway. And yes, we went to church every Sunday. I went to a little sort of Sunday school as well.
And presumably in boarding school, there were chapel services. And
it was an Anglo-Catholic
right.
Background, boarding school. And so we were in chapel every morning and 3 times on a Sunday.
And what, you know, if I had met you, say, in teenage years and said, are you a Christian, what would you have said, Fiona?
Yes, never occurred to me that I wasn't.
But was God somebody who you took seriously?
I took him very seriously because I was always brought up to believe that God was looking at me and I had to do everything that he would approve of.
So is it a finger-wagging God?
Absolutely, and I was having to match up to get enough brownie points to get to heaven. It was that sort of thing. You better behave, you know. And, you know, one of the things that I always remember my mother saying, and it was, I didn't realise actually that it was from the Bible, I suppose, but it was always think of others as better than yourself, which was a Bible
concept,
you know, yes. And that's how I was brought up, had to be polite and submissive.
All right, so boarding school, and then was there a break when suddenly you became a great entertainer?
No, I'm afraid not. I wish. I was so ambitious. I wanted
to. You were
never
spotted then?
Well, not really, no. I realised that I wasn't good enough to get into a ballet company when I got to student level when I was about 16 or 17. And in those days, if you didn't get good enough to get into a ballet company, and you have to do all these auditions and things, then the next best thing was to go into the chorus of summer seasons, pantomimes and shows all over the country. In those days, it was quite normal to be in a summer season, which is a variety show that functions all around the coast, of Great Britain, or used to. And then a pantomime. And so that was a sort of ritual that you did. And you tried to get yourself into the longest running pantomime and then the longest running summer season. So you had as little time to starve in between as possible. and that's what I aimed to do in initial stages. And then I sort of graduated into being principal girl in pantomime and what they call soubrette in summer seasons, which meant that I did the principal dancing, the singing, and the sketches with the comedians. So I did a bit of everything, which was lovely. I loved every minute.
The most memorable part you ever played?
Oh, well, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I played Liesl in the original cast of The Sound of Music.
Oh,
which
right.
Which was 1961.
And were you 16 going on 17 when you
74
played
74 or 5.
All right.
Yes, I was. No, I was 21.
All right, okay. Yes. Now, how did you meet Roy?
Well, the very first pantomime I did after I left school was at the Coventry Hippodrome, and fortunately for me, it was the longest running pantomime in the country. Can you believe it ran until April? Can you imagine that today? Pantomime running till April. Anyway, that was great for me because it meant that I had work. And Harry Secombe was top of the bill. Do you remember Harry Secombe? Some of you might remember.
He ruled the world, didn't he?
He certainly did, yes, one time. And then Morecambe and Wise were second on the bill. And I expect you all remember, even if you weren't born at the time, you
sunshine,
remember.
Bring me sunshine, yes.
And I got to know Eric Morecambe really well, and Joan, his wife, and he had two little children at the time. And they were very good to me. Maintained a friendship with them over the years. I did other shows with them after that pantomime. And occasionally, Eric and Joan used to invite me to their home for a weekend. And it was always great fun, you know.
Was it great fun? Was he the same at home as he was, say, on television?
Yes, he was lovely. I mean, he was just a laugh a minute. You can imagine, can't you? He didn't care what he said to anybody.
Did he ever say you'd got short, fat, hairy legs?
Not quite, but he told me I needed to get my nose done. He said, you need a nose job. You and Joan better go and have a nose job done together.
Did he really?
That made me feel good, didn't it? No, but you take everything.
Yeah, so he was great fun.
Great fun, yes.
It was, I suppose, very generous, very kind, big-hearted of them to take
Well, they were
in.
Lovely. They knew I was a starving dancer, so they used to invite me in. For the weekend, and they would feed me up, and then they'd give me all the leftovers to take back to my little garret flat in London.
Is that right?
So I didn't starve for the rest of the week. Yes, they were lovely, really good friends.
But you still haven't mentioned Roy yet.
Oh, Roy. Well, that happened because we were sitting down in their home one evening watching television, and Roy happened to come on the television. And I'd seen Roy at the Palladium and thought he was really talented. It was just when he'd become well known. And I thought he was so brilliant. And so I just said to Eric in a very stupid moment, oh, ever you do a show with Roy Castle, can I come along? Because I'd love to meet him. Mm. All right, love. And that was the end of the conversation. Mm. probably about 2 years later, when I was actually in The Sound of Music and Eric and Ernie were at the Palladium, Eric phoned me at the theatre and said, hey, Fiona, I'm doing a television with Roy on Sunday. Do you want to come along? Oh, yes, please. So off I went with Joan, Eric's wife, and went to watch the show. And just before the show started, Eric took me into Roy's dressing room to introduce me, and I was so excited. I thought it was going to be such a brilliant moment. And he just said, Roy, this is Fiona. She's in love with you, and then left.
But were you?
Yes. But it was the worst moment of my life. Can you imagine him doing a thing like that? And left me blushing up to the roots of my then blonde hair, wishing I could die. And I was really quite a shy person, and so was Roy, actually. Mm. And so we just looked at each other, couldn't think of anything to say after that. But anyway, later on, we all went out for a meal, and things got a bit better after that.
And he said, can we meet again?
Yes, he did, actually.
And
yes.
How was your heart at that sound? Boom, 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 boom.
Yes, I'm so excited.
All right, and so eventually you were to marry Roy.
Yes.
Now, for those who don't remember, Roy Castle, this is how I recall him anyway. Famous, of course, because he did that series of Record Breakers on the BBC. We'll talk about that in a moment. But he was immense fun, but incredibly talented, wasn't he? I think he still holds the Guinness Book of Records for the number of instruments he played in something like 4 minutes.
Well, does he? I haven't looked at them.
But he was a bundle of life, but he was a tap dancer as well, but he was clean. There was never any smut, was there, with Roy?
He always said, right from the start, that he wanted to be able to entertain anybody without anyone feeling embarrassed, whether they were grandparents or children, that he could always feel comfortable giving whatever performance he had to do.
And again, was he the same at home as he was on stage?
Yes, what you saw was what you got with him. There was no side to him at all. And I think in those days, there wasn't the celebrity status that there is today. You know, Roy always said he was really glad to be able to earn a living doing something he really enjoyed. And that was the bottom line. And that was it. He was self-taught in everything except tap dancing. He taught himself all the instruments that he ever played. Hmm. When he went into the RAF to do his national service, his uncle, who was a musician, because it was a real brass band country, you know, where he came from.
Oh,
you
I do know.
You
yes.
do remember that.
I do. Still is, yes.
And he was the trumpet player. So he
was the trumpet his main instrument, Fiona?
Well, it was the first instrument he learned, because his uncle gave him a trumpet when he went into the RAF, saying, "There you are, lad, you might as well do something useful whilst you're doing your national service." So he drove everybody bonkers on the in the billet, playing his trumpet all the time, practicing. And the only reason he got away with it was that he'd also been trained to be a barber. So he used to cut all the other guys' hair in the billet for free, save them paying one and threepence, you know, whatever.
All right, so you married. Now, what was life like as a married, you know, wife of this very, very famous entertainer?
Well, it was really exciting because when we got married, I made a decision to give up my career. I was still in the show. I gave up being in The Sound of Music just before I got married because Roy was working mostly in the United States. He was doing really well over there, doing a lot of television in New York, which was full network right across the States, and working in Las Vegas and Hollywood and so on. So I'd never seen any of these places anyway. I was really excited. I could never been on holiday even because I could never afford it. So it was really exciting for me to go to places I'd only seen on maps. So it was brilliant.
So, and presumably he was doing well. You know, he'd be getting a good income compared with many. It should have been a great lifestyle.
Yes, it
But it wasn't straightforward for you, was it?
No. After a while, it became difficult because we made a conscious decision that if we had children, that I would always stay at home to be the anchor for them. Roy would have to travel when he had to and come back when he could. I was really happy with that. I had four children, and of course the time came. I tried to travel with him as much as possible during that time, but the time came when the children had to go to school, so Roy had to go off on his own and I was at home. That wasn't a problem because I really loved my job. I loved being a mom. I loved being a homemaker and whatever. But my problem was such a sad, pathetic problem, but it seems to be quite a common one, was that I felt rubbish. I was absolutely rubbish at everything. And I'd look around at my friends doing the same sort of thing I was trying to do, and they seemed to do it without any fuss at all, and everything seemed to be easy for them. And for me, it was always a struggle, and I never felt I matched up to anybody. And one of the things that I discovered a lot later was that it's so easy for us to look at other people's strengths and look back at our own weaknesses. And we fail to see that other people have weaknesses and we have strengths that maybe they haven't got. But all I could see was my own inability to do stuff the way my friends could do things.
Were you a perfectionist?
I think that was the problem. And the trouble with being a perfectionist, I always wanted to do everything really well. And I think the main reason that I wanted to do everything well was that I wanted to make sure Roy was glad that he'd chosen me as a wife. You know, I really wanted to please him. But I always felt that I failed. And I think I was a perfectionist. And the trouble with being a perfectionist is that you're always a failure because you never match up to your own expectation of what that perfection should be. And I was always struggling and striving to be this perfect wife, mother, homemaker, hostess, whatever it took. And I always felt that I was no good at it. Nobody would have known because I always pretended that I was okay because I put a mask in front of my face and had a smile on, you know, but nobody knew what was really going on the inside.
It's one thing to go to chapel services when you're at boarding school. Did you go to church as a family?
Yes, we continued to go to church. In fact, we were married in church. I insisted that Roy got confirmed before we got married so that we could go to communion together. We had our children christened. I was very involved with the local church and so on.
So what, was there a mask on at church as well?
Oh, yes. Roy used to say, I don't know why you bother to go to church, because by the time you've got the children into the car and all ready to go, you're in such a foul mood, it can't possibly do you any good. And he was right, you know, but as soon as I go through the church door, good morning, everybody. Why are you laughing? Are you the same?
All right, so there are issues. There are issues in everybody's life. Fiona, and that was an issue for you. But this really spiralled down, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I mean, when you look at me and my life, I must have been one of the most privileged people that you could have imagined. I had a wonderful husband who loved me, who provided for me. I didn't have to work outside the home in order to help to pay a mortgage. I had four beautiful, healthy children, a lovely home with everything in it that opened and shut. You know, what else could anybody want? Materially, I was well off. Emotionally and spiritually, I was in a mess. And that was my problem. But
Were you depressed?
Yes, I was very, very low in my spirit. I would have called myself depressed, except it wasn't a clinical depression that needed drugs to help me. It was just very, very low, feeling terrible.
And Roy was aware of this?
He was aware of it, bless his heart. He tried so hard to make life work for me and encourage me, but I always came back to this place of failure, whatever happened.
Was there anybody you could talk with?
I would never have talked to a family member or a friend. I was far too proud because I didn't want to let the side down. I always wanted to, you know, make out that I was okay. So I never told anybody. But there came a day when I was so down and really beginning to feel, quite honestly, that the planet would be better off if I wasn't on it. That one day, in utter desperation, I went up to my bedroom after I'd taken the children to school, shut the door, got down on my knees, and I just cried out to God. And I said, God, if you're there, you've got to help me, and you've got to help me now, because I've had it. I can't go on any longer. And I meant it. That's all I said. And I don't honestly think I expected God to even hear me, let alone do anything about it. And I was beginning to wonder if he was really there. Or
had you ever prayed in desperation like that before?
Never.
So it was a first time.
It was a first time. I'd always, you know, sort of prayed the standard prayers to, you know, God bless mummy and daddy and the children, that sort of thing, you know. That was what I'd been taught. And I would go through all the prayers in the prayer book. But that prayer was the most desperate moment of my life.
And what happened?
I hadn't even got up off my knees before the phone rang. And when I answered the phone, the person who was at the other end was a woman I'd met probably about twice. I never really would have expected her to phone me socially. But I did know she was a Christian. And she just said, Fiona, I don't know why I'm phoning you, but I've had you on my mind recently and I had this sudden urge to ring you. She said, I feel as if you need to talk. I don't know why, and I don't know what you need to talk about, but would you like to come over and have a coffee with me and talk? Well, I had to recognize that as God's amazing answer to that desperate cry for help. So I went round to her house then and there. I couldn't wait because I felt, well, this is my one chance. And I dumped Benjamin, our baby, who was just over a year old, into Roy's arms and said, I'm going out, and left. And he told me later he thought I'd literally left for good, left him holding the baby. He was probably quite relieved about it because of the way I'd been behaving, poor guy. He was such a lovely person. He was always happy if everybody around him was happy, and I was the one that wasn't working with. Anyway, I went round to this person's house. I think because I didn't know her very well, I felt free to talk to her. You know, she didn't know any of my friends and so on, so it was easy to talk. And I just dumped on her. And as I said before, my problems were not very great, but they were life and death to me. And she heard me out. And then she asked me the most challenging question anybody has ever asked me in my life. She simply said, you know, Fiona, you think you're a Christian because you go to church, but have you ever invited Jesus to come in and take over your life? I said, no, I hadn't. I didn't know you were supposed to. As far as I was aware, that wasn't in the Book of Common Prayer, you know. I thought I'd done all the things I was supposed to do by singing hymns, saying the prayers, and, you know, all of those things. And so when I said no, she said, well, don't you think it's about time you did? And so I said yes. And I only said yes because I was afraid to say no. I didn't know what it would mean. I thought maybe I'd never be allowed to wear makeup again and, you know, put my hair in a bun and wear sandals and socks for the rest of my life. You know, that sort of... But fortunately for me, she was very attractive, a lovely lady, very pretty, beautifully dressed and lovely makeup. So I thought, well, maybe it'll work. So she led me to the Lord. She helped me to pray a really simple prayer. She had to help me pray because I wasn't very good at praying. And the prayer went something like this. Please, Jesus, forgive me for the mess I've made of my marriage, my family, my life. I recognize the way I've tried to run my life hasn't worked. So now you come in and take it over and see what you can do with the rest of it. Simple as that. And at that very moment, he did. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know how to react or anything like that. But suddenly, I experienced peace that I never knew was possible. It was like all the tension, anxiety, fear, worry that I'd lived with for most of my life started to drain away. And in place of it came this amazing peace. It was like somebody pouring healing oil all over me and right through me and touching every part of my life. And I knew something amazing had happened. I wasn't quite sure what or how it would work out in reality once I got back into the family. But I knew that I was different from that moment onwards.
So you went back and told Roy?
No. Can you imagine if I'd gone back and said, oh, it's all right now, darling, I've become a Christian, so everything. He'd have probably done a runner thinking I've got religious mania as well as everything else, you know. So, no, God in his wisdom, just on that little journey, it's about a mile from this lady's house to mine, showed me that I shouldn't tell Roy anything that had happened, but I had to live out what I'd discovered by being different, not by telling him I was different, but by showing him by the way I lived my life from that moment onwards. So I didn't say a word, went back to the house just to get on with my life. And Roy said that as I came through that door, it was as if somebody had painted our house in 2 seconds flat. I'd gone out and it was all black and gloomy, come back in and it was all light and bright and sunny. But he said he thought it might be a 5-minute wonder, so he didn't ask. So it took him a while to realize that it was more than just a 5-minute wonder. And then he began to ask me questions. Where did you go that day? And who did you speak to? And what's happened to you? And why are you being nice to me? And things like that. So then I felt free to tell him what had happened. I told him. And he just said, oh, thank goodness. He said, I've been praying for years that you'd see the light and become a reasonable human being again. So I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, because he always had a very simple faith that went on right through to the end of his life.
Now, I want to talk about that. Time's moving on, but I do want to explore this, if I may. And I'm always conscious, you know, these are sensitive issues, but of course, we know Roy, we know about his life. He did these amazing things from record breakers. But he was diagnosed with lung cancer. And the thing about Roy, because he was a celebrity, it was a very, very public illness, wasn't it? I'll just see if I can repair this for a second.
Sorry.
If I can tuck that in there. Which I can't. Now try do it.
Right. I won't touch it anymore.
Be boring. I'll tell you what, why don't we just put that on your lap?
I was told to put it on
there.
Oh,
were you? All right, we better do what we're talking about.
I do as I'm told.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's... So this very public illness, how did he hear, and then how did you hear that he had lung cancer?
Yes, it was a great shock because Roy had never been a smoker. And he actually contracted a virus a couple of days after he'd come back from Australia, and I thought it was just jet lag, so I was teasing him for not getting over jet lag. And suddenly we had to call the ambulance, and they thought he'd had a heart attack and was going to die, and it turned out to be this virus. And I think that was what set the cancer, which was sort of latent in his body, going. And they were starting to do lots of tests on him, and eventually he had to go to the specialist one evening to get the prognosis. And it was quite interesting because it was a lovely guy called Dave Foster who had a charity that he was involved with, and he'd come to meet up with Roy that evening to do a voiceover for a charitable video that he was doing. And so he was waiting in the kitchen with me, and Roy was quite late coming back from the specialist. And Roy came into the room eventually and said, right, he said, I've got lung cancer. He said, it's the fastest growing kind of lung cancer. He said, without treatment, I've got 6 months to live. With treatment, I've got 3 months to live, and it's inoperable. Okay, Dave, let's get on with that video. And they went and sorted out this video, leaving me in total shock. Because it never occurred to me that anybody who never smoked would get lung cancer. I'd always associated the two together. And I felt as if I'd turned to lead, and I didn't know what to do. So I just prayed and said, God, what are you doing? What is happening here? And it was almost as if I heard an audible voice in the room saying, stand back and see what I'm going to do through this. And suddenly I realized God hadn't abandoned us. He knew what was happening, and all he was asking was that we would allow him to work through the circumstances we happened to be in at that particular time. And that enabled it to go right back to normal. And actually, all the way through, from that moment onwards, we saw God's opportunities through the cancer that Roy had. Roy was never keen on publicity. In fact, the newspapers always left him alone because we lived such boring lives. They never had anything interesting to say about us. But suddenly, as a result of them finding out about Roy's cancer, they were all over us like flies. And Roy didn't tell them, but probably somebody else must have done after about 2 weeks into Roy's treatment.
Now, you said, so 3 months life expectancy without treatment, 6 months with treatment. How long did he have?
He actually lived 2.5 years. And I have to say that every day of those 2.5 years was a bonus. You know, you just make the most of it.
But how as a Christian, Fiona, because you saw him really go downhill. He lost his hair. We remember those pictures of
him. Oh, there was a lovely story about his hair. Can I tell the story? His hair started to fall out after a few treatments. And one evening he was in the bath and he just was pulling all his hair out, and he laid it all at the front of the bath. And he said, he called us all into the bathroom and said, here you are, this brings a whole new meaning to wash and go.
So he didn't spiral into depression or despondency?
No, he just saw every moment as a bonus as well. And he said, we must never complain. He said, we've had a fantastic marriage. We've had a wonderful life. I've had a fantastic bite of the cherry. We must always be grateful for what we've had. And he was insistent that we saw the positive side with gratitude for all that we had. And we had so much to be grateful for.
And you said about the journalist, but he really, when he was with the journalist, he just told them all about Jesus, didn't he? He was out to, as it were, say that from now on I want you to know I'm a real Christian.
It was quite extraordinary because the press, once they got to hear about it, they were all at the door, you know, sort of loads of them the first morning that the papers had mentioned it. And when they'd all gone, Roy turned to me and said, well, I don't know what they're going to put in the papers, but he said, I've told them all about Jesus. And I went, what? And he'd always been very careful about how he'd spoken about his faith. He'd been very real with it, with all the people that he worked with, but he said, I don't want to become known as a crank. But he said, but now, he said, I've got a platform. He said, if my faith hadn't been real, it would have gone out of the window when I got cancer. But now it's more real than ever. And so, you know, he had a wonderful opportunity to share his faith through that time.
Were you with him when he died?
I was, yes.
And how many years ago was that?
Nearly 20, yes.
Do you look back at all and think, why me?
No, I don't. And Roy always said, why not me? He said, other people get problems, why should I be exempt? And, you know, I feel I've just had such a privileged life. And
Do you ever feel self-pity at all?
That's a very interesting question, actually, because I can say no now. But the little story is that Roy wrote his autobiography, and the publishers were trying to get it published before Roy died, but unfortunately it didn't manage to happen until 2 weeks after he died. And I felt sorry for the publishers, so I said to them, well, if there's anything I can do to help, please let me know, thinking, well, maybe I'd be interviewed by a couple of, you know, newspapers or something. And within days, I was sent over to Northern Ireland to do what was called the Gerry Kelly Show, which is a bit like a Michael Parkinson chat show, you know. And so I did that. I was terrified to do anything like that because that wasn't my brief at all, but still I did it. And came back. And you know how when you get to Heathrow, you come out and there's a concourse and then all the taxi drivers are waiting with people's names and people are waiting to collect people. Well, I came out, and I came out right behind a lovely young woman, and she fell into a guy's arms right in front of me. And I just burst into tears. Then and there, I couldn't walk any further. I thought, oh, I haven't got anybody to meet me at the airport. Oh, I'm all on my own, and I've got to make my way to the long-term car park and get my car out and drive home to an empty house, you know. And it was all... And suddenly, I realized that those were tears of self-pity. They weren't tears of grief. Poor old me is not fair. And at that moment, I made a decision that I would never allow myself tears of self-pity. Tears of grief, yes, any time, but tears of self-pity, never, because that's a slippery slope down to depression, and I thought, I'm not going that way. So, I mean, the people at the airport must have thought I was totally bonkers, because I then gave myself a dressing down. Stupid woman, pull yourself together. You've had a wonderful marriage for 31 years. Now get back to that long-term car park and drive your car home and stop complaining. Can you imagine that?
You've had a remarkable sort of ministry, a huge long chapter of your life where you've really gone all over the country. You've spoken to people about Jesus and what's happened to you and Christian faith. Is it more than just religion now? Is it a relationship with God that is real and vibrant?
It became that day. The 25th of February 1975 was my birthday. That was it's not my real birthday.
We can tell. I'm sorry.
Shall I leave? Do you know, that was the best day of my life. It was the best thing that ever happened. And from that day onwards, I had a burning inside to share Jesus with people. I wanted to tell people that Jesus can change a life. I get so fed up with newspapers today and so on, worrying about gay marriage or gay bishops or all these things that are peripheral. Who's going to care about them? You know, who's going to be enticed into going to church or understanding about faith if this is all they hear about the bickering that goes on out? Oh, it makes me mad, because I want to tell the world that Jesus can change a life. He can change a nation. He is the only one who can make a difference in this world now, in our nation, to bring back the values of the Ten Commandments, you know, right back to the beginning. I just long for people to understand. I'm not a perfectionist anymore. If you come to my house now, you can run your fingers along the windowsill and there'll be a great big layer of dust. If you want to come to my house for a meal, it'll be bread and cheese around the kitchen table, okay? I love people. I want to engage with conversation with people, not be worried about whether the meal is going to be good enough and all the rest of it. In fact, I've got a personal chef who does all my cooking. There are two chefs, Mr. Marks and Mr. Spencer.
Can I just remind you, they were from Leeds.
I can't win with this guy, can I?
You've never regretted that moment of Christian conversion then?
No, and I still have the burning inside, the longing that people would understand what it really means.
Heaven, do you look forward to heaven?
Yes, I can't wait.
To see Roy?
I think I'll be so taken up with what's going on in heaven that I won't even worry about that. I mean, I have always a conversation with Roy in heaven, you know, and it's mostly another fine mess you've got me into. If it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't be here. No. But, you know, yes, heaven. And whatever God has for me in heaven, I'm up for it.
And you're there not because you're good enough, but because of Jesus. That's the
point. No, that's the best thing. I don't have to try to please God. I long to be where God wants me to be. I discovered when I became a Christian that my place of peace would be being where God wants me to be, whether it's right in the background, whether anybody ever speaks to me again or not. So long as I'm where God wants me to be, doing what he wants me to do, that's my place of peace. And that's all. That's what I long for. And I just want people to know that it's not how good you are or how hard you try. You know, as I said, when I was a child, I was always taught to try really hard to please God so that you get to heaven when you die. But it's nothing to do with that. It's actually having a relationship with God through Jesus. And Jesus has paid the price, and I didn't understand it. Do you know, there's still so much, I don't know if I've ever said this before, but there's still so much about the Bible and about Jesus and about God that I don't understand. But I believe it with all my heart because Jesus changed my life. And that's the bottom line.
Fiona, thank you very much. Now, Fiona and I have been together before, and I know she always stays to the very end, so everybody's very welcome to come and chat. You love to chat, and if anybody wants to pray with you or chat with you, you'll be around, won't you? Shall we show our appreciation? Thank you very much. Thank you.